The first thing I noticed wasn't the smell of another woman or a strange charge on a credit card. It was the way the light hit the dust motes in our bedroom at 4 in the afternoon. I was standing there holding a stack of his folded undershirts, and the silence of the house suddenly felt like a physical weight pressing against my eardrums. It was a Tuesday. It was a normal, unremarkable Tuesday, until I found the second phone taped to the underside of his nightstand. I didn't even know why I was reaching under there. Maybe I'd dropped a sock. Maybe some part of my body knew what my brain was refusing to see for 10 years. When my fingers brushed that cold plastic casing, the floor didn't just drop away. It vanished. I sat on the edge of our Egyptian cotton sheets, the ones we picked out together for our 15th anniversary, and I realized that my entire life was a house built on smoke. The phone wasn't locked. He was always arrogant like that, thinking his shadows were impenetrable because he played the part of the devoted suburban father so well. I scrolled through a decade of a parallel life. There were names I didn't recognize and photos of places he told me he was visiting for work. There were expressions on his face in those digital frames that I hadn't seen in years. A looseness, a predatory kind of joy. I looked at the undershirts in my lap. They were white, bleached and folded into perfect squares. I had spent a decade bleaching the stains out of a life that was already rotted to the core. My hands started to shake, not with a tremor, but with a violent rhythmic jerking that made the phone clatter against the floorboards. I couldn't breathe, but I didn't scream. I just sat there in the quiet light, staring at a small silver earring I found wedged in the charging port of that phone. It wasn't mine. I don't wear silver. I kept that earring. I didn't confront him that night, or the next. I put the earring in a small velvet-lined ring box and hid it inside a box of stale crackers in the back of the pantry. It became my secret anchor, the only hard physical fact in a world that had suddenly become liquid. Every time he came home and kissed my cheek, smelling like the office and expensive espresso, I would feel the weight of that silver stud in the pantry. It was a small, sharp piece of the truth that I wasn't ready to say out loud. For those first few days, I lived in a state of suspended animation. I made school lunches. I signed permission slips. I watched him help our son with his long division at the kitchen table, his hand resting casually on the boy's shoulder, and I felt a physical sickness so intense I had to grip the edge of the granite countertop until my knuckles turned white. The sickness isn't metaphorical. Grief, when it's born from a betrayal this deep, is a systemic infection. By day 10, my hair started falling out in clumps in the shower. I would stand there watching the blonde strands swirl around the drain, and I'd think about how much of myself I had given to maintain the image of us. We were the gold standard couple in our circle. We hosted the fundraisers. We had the lawn that people stopped to admire. We were the ones people came to for marriage advice. The irony was a bitter metallic taste in the back of my throat that never went away. I stopped eating, not because I wanted to lose weight, but because the very idea of nourishment felt like a lie. My body was rejecting the world. I remember the smell of the lawyer's office, 3 weeks in. It smelled like old paper and lemon-scented furniture polish. It was a sterile, expensive smell. I sat across from a man who had seen 1,000 versions of me, and I realized I was just a case file. He talked about equitable distribution and parenting time, as if we were discussing the liquidation of a dry cleaning business. He told me that in our state, infidelity didn't really matter for the bottom line. 10 years of a secret life. 10 years of gaslighting. 10 years of me wondering why I felt so lonely in a crowded room. It was all legally irrelevant. I looked at the dust dancing in the light of his window and felt a sudden sharp longing for the silver earring in the cracker box. I wanted to throw it onto his mahogany desk and scream that this was a crime, even if there was no statute for it. The gaslighting started the moment I finally laid the phone on the kitchen island. He didn't cry. He didn't beg. He looked at me with a terrifyingly calm expression and told me I was being hysterical. He said he'd bought that phone for security reasons for work. He told me the photos were from a stag party years ago that he'd forgotten to delete. He looked me in the eye and told me that my memory of our last decade was the problem, not his actions. It's a specific kind of torture, having someone you've shared a bed with for 20 years try to rewrite the software of your brain. I started keeping a journal, not of my feelings, but of facts. Tuesday. He said he was at the gym. The car's GPS shows he was at the Marriott. Thursday, he told me I was imagining the smell of perfume. I found the receipt in his coat pocket. The kids are the barometers. They are 14 and 12, old enough to feel the atmospheric pressure change, but young enough to still need the sky to stay in one piece. I watched them, watching me. Every time I lingered too long staring at the microwave, or every time my voice cracked when I asked about their day, I could see them gauging the wind. They were looking at me to see if the world was a place where you could survive a catastrophe. If I collapsed, the wreckage would bury them too. So I performed. I became a master of the suburban mom mask. I went to the soccer games. I cheered from the sidelines. I felt like a ghost haunting my own life, watching this woman in a fleece vest pretend that her heart wasn't a blackened charcoal remains. One afternoon, about 40 days in, I was scrubbing the floor of the guest bathroom. I was on my hands and knees, the scent of bleach stinging my eyes, and I realized I was trying to scrub away the feeling of being replaced. I was looking for a hair, a smudge, anything that didn't belong to me. I found a small pink hair tie behind the toilet. It was a cheap thing, the kind you buy in bulk at a drugstore. It looked like a coiled snake on the white tile. I stared at it for a long time. I didn't cry. I just picked it up and put it in the velvet box with the earring. My collection was growing. These were the artifacts of my erasure. The legal process felt like a second betrayal. His lawyer sent over a proposal that suggested I should move out of the house we'd built because he needed the space for his home office. It was a calculated move, a way to see how much of my dignity I had left to trade for peace. I sat in my car in the driveway of the grocery store and screamed until my throat was raw. I screamed at the steering wheel, at the bags of organic kale in the back seat, at the stupid perfect life I had spent 15 years curated. No one heard me. People walked by with their carts, their lives seemingly intact, and I realized that everyone is carrying a box of crackers with a secret inside. I started to notice things I'd been blind to for a decade. I noticed the way he checked his watch when I talked about my day. I noticed the way he never really looked at our daughter's eyes when she told a joke. I realized that the perfect husband I was mourning never actually existed. He was a character I had helped him write. I had provided the editing, the set design, and the supporting cast. I was the one who made sure the birthdays were remembered and the bills were paid so he could have the freedom to build a basement for his lies. The shame wasn't just about his cheating. It was about my own complicity in the myth. I had wanted the gold standard so badly that I had ignored the smell of smoke for 10 years. By day 60, the numbness started to crack, and the rage moved in. It was a cold, surgical anger. I stopped being the victim in the lawyer's office and started being a bookkeeper. I went through every bank statement from the last decade. I found the business dinners that were actually weekend getaways. I found the jewelry purchases that never ended up in my jewelry box. I mapped out the geography of his betrayal with the precision of a general. Every time I found a new lie, I felt a strange, dark sense of empowerment. I wasn't crazy. I wasn't hysterical. I was right. The truth was a jagged, ugly thing, but it was solid. I could stand on it. I remember a moment in the kitchen, around day 75. My daughter was sitting at the island, doing her homework. She looked up and said, "Mom, you look different." I froze. I thought she saw the cracks. I thought she saw the ghost. But then she said, "You look like you're actually here now." It hit me like a physical blow. For 10 years, I had been so busy maintaining the facade of a happy marriage that I hadn't actually been present in my own life. I had been a curator, not a person. My daughter saw the difference between a polished lie and a messy, grieving truth. It was the first time I felt like I might actually survive. Speaking up has consequences. The gold standard circle narrowed almost instantly. Some people didn't want to be around the mess. They were afraid the divorce was contagious. Or maybe they were afraid that if they looked too closely at my life, they'd have to look at their own. I stopped being invited to the Friday night wine pours. I saw the whispers at the school gate. The cost of the truth is often isolation. But the cost of silence was my soul. If I had stayed, if I had worked through it for the sake of the house and the lawn, I would have been teaching my children that their own boundaries were negotiable. I would have been telling my daughter that a man's comfort is worth more than her own reality. The mirror is still a difficult place to look. I see a woman who is 10 pounds thinner and has deeper lines around her eyes. I see a woman who doesn't recognize the kitchen she's standing in, but I also see a woman who isn't hiding a second phone. I see a woman who knows exactly what is in her cracker box. The 90-day mark didn't bring closure. There is no such thing as a clean break when your life has been intertwined with a liar for half of it. It's more like a slow, painful peeling of skin. Last night, I took the silver earring and the pink hair tie out of the velvet box. I drove to the bridge over the creek near the park where we used to take the kids when they were toddlers. It was a quiet, humid night, the air thick with the smell of damp earth and coming rain. I stood there for a long time, holding those small, cheap pieces of someone else's life. I thought about throwing them in, making some grand gesture of letting go. But I didn't. I put them back in my pocket. I'm not ready to throw them away yet. They are my receipts. They are the proof that I am not crazy. I went home and sat in the dark living room. The house felt huge and empty, stripped of the noise of the man who used to fill it with his fabricated stories. My son came downstairs for a glass of water. He saw me sitting there and sat down on the floor next to my chair. He didn't say anything. He just leaned his head against my knee. We sat there in the dark for a long time. The silence didn't feel like a wait anymore. It felt like a space. A space where something new might eventually grow, even if the soil is still full of ash. I don't know who I am yet. Without the gold standard title, I don't know what my life looks like 91 days from now. But I know that when I wake up tomorrow, I won't have to check the underside of a nightstand to know where I stand. The realization that comes late is always the hardest one to swallow. I realize that for 10 years, I wasn't just protecting him. I was protecting my own idea of myself as a woman who couldn't be fooled. I was protecting the girl who thought she'd made all the right choices. Admitting he was a stranger meant admitting I had been a stranger to myself. The trap wasn't just his infidelity. The trap was the life I'd agreed to live in order to feel safe. I gave up my intuition for a nice zip code. I traded my knowing for a sense of belonging that was contingent on me staying blind. Today, the light hit the dust motes in the bedroom again. It's a Tuesday. I'm standing in the same spot, but the undershirts are gone. The room is half empty, and the walls look a little scarred where the pictures used to hang. My hair is still thin, and my stomach still turns when the phone rings, but I can breathe. The air in this house is different now. It's colder. Maybe. It's certainly quieter. But for the first time in a decade, the air is real. I'm not sure if I'm picking up the pieces, or if I'm just standing in the rubble, looking for something that was never broken to begin with. Maybe that's the only part of me that's left. The part that stayed sane while the world was being incinerated. I still haven't told my mother the whole truth. I haven't told the neighbors why the moving truck was there on a Sunday morning. I'm still protecting something, though I'm not entirely sure what it is anymore. Maybe I'm just protecting the children from the full weight of their father's capacity for cruelty. Or maybe I'm protecting the last shred of the woman who believed in the gold standard. It's hard to let the legend die, even when the legend was trying to kill you. I look at the mirror one more time before I head out to the grocery store. I don't smile. I don't look empowered. I just look at the woman staring back at me, and I whisper, "I see you." And for today, that has to be enough. The consequence of staying silent would have been a slow death of the spirit. I would have become a shell. A ghost wife in a ghost house, wondering every time he was 10 minutes late if the world was about to end again. The consequence of speaking up is this. The mess, the lawyer's fees, the pitying looks at the PTA meetings, and the terrifying uncertainty of a bank account in my name only. It's a high price to pay for the truth. But as I walk out the door and feel the cold air hit my face, I realize I've never been more awake. I am 90 days into the rest of my life. The pieces are still on the floor, but at least I can see them now. I know what I'm holding, and I know that I will never, ever fold another man's bleached undershirts as long as I live.